Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Today, I'm delighted to be in conversation with Judith Enck. Judith Enck is currently a visiting scholar at the Elizabeth Hawbes School of Law at Pace University and was a former regional administrator. That's a huge job at the Environmental Protection Agency for our region. In 2009, Judith Enck was appointed regional administrator of Region 2 of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, by President Barack Obama. Enck stepped down from her EPA position on January 20th, 2017. She was the longest-serving EPA Region 2 administrator. Previously, she was Deputy Secretary for the Environment in New York State Governor's Office. As regional administrator, Judith's responsibilities are wide-ranging in cooperation with state and regional authorities in New York, New Jersey, Puerto Rico, the U.S. Virgin Islands, and 8 federally recognized Indian nations. Region 2 administers federal programs governing air and water pollution, industrial discharges, toxic substances, pesticides, protection of streams, lakes and ocean, solid and hazardous waste, the cleanup of chemical spills, and abandoned hazardous waste sites. In Judy's prior position, she was responsible for policies and operations of New York State's Environmental Protection Agency, including the Department of Environmental Conservation, Office of Parks, Recreation and Historic Preservation, Adirondack Park Agency, Agriculture and Markets, Department of State, and others. Judith previously served 8 years as policy director for the New York State Attorney General. Prior to that, she was senior environmental associate with the New York Public Interest Research Group. She's also served as the executive director of the Environmental Advocates of New York, a nonprofit watchdog organization. She's a past president of Hudson River Sloop Clearwater, former executive director of the nonprofit Resource Center, and a designer of her town's recycling program. She worked with the New York State Legislature to pass a number of the state's far-reaching environmental laws, including those addressing acid, rain, toxics, pesticides, recycling, energy conservation, and environmental funding. Her accomplishments in the field of environmental protection have been recognized with professional awards from the Attorney General's Office, the Sierra Club, Center for Women in Government, Citizen Action, the Long Island Pine Barrens Society, and others. She's a graduate of the College of St. Rose in Albany, New York. And one more thing, she's my hero. Welcome, Judith Enck.
Thanks, Alan. It's a real privilege to be back here at WAMC.
Well, as you know, we've been following your career for many years, and you've always been the person who knew more about this area than anybody that we know, and you have guts that other people will never have. Okay, let's start with the obvious question. Okay, Judith Enck, Donald Trump is the President of the United States. It's clear he doesn't believe in climate change or anything else. What do you make of this whole thing?
Well, it's a mess. And my former colleagues at the EPA are really concerned about whether they're going to be able to do their job on the day-to-day basis, whether they're going to have the budget at EPA slashed. And for people who care about clean air and clean water and cleaning up our toxic legacy here in the Hudson Valley and beyond, this is a pretty serious moment. It's hard to get our heads around it every day, but the president has nominated Attorney General Scott Pruitt from Oklahoma, who has a very hostile view of the role of the EPA. In fact, he's sued EPA 14 times when he was Attorney General in Oklahoma. I'm really worried about the future of the EPA and, more importantly, the agency's ability to stand up to protect the environment at a time when we need a forward-looking, aggressive EPA to tackle issues like climate change and drinking water. This is the most serious threat to the EPA in its 47-year history.
So is it likely, having to live through 4 years, I'm assuming, of this president, that the environment in this country will be ruined?
Well, it will be degraded. The president said he wants to eliminate the EPA. I don't think he's going to get away with that, but he will slash the budget. He will limit enforcement of environmental laws, and that translates into more pollution. A few days before I left the EPA, my former colleagues had a really nice going away reception for me, and I spoke to all of them who are pretty shaken by what they're facing, and I said, the career professional staff at EPA, the civil servants, are the firewall 99.5% of EPA staff are career civil servants. They're scientists and lawyers and engineers. And they need to stand up and they need to get very familiar with the whistleblower law and make sure that this erosion doesn't happen. Now, this is unprecedented, which is Attorney General Scott Pruitt becoming EPA administrator, a man who sued the agency 14 times and who, by the way, has said that he will not recuse himself on those lawsuits. So he's going to be on the other side. I just don't understand that.
You know, you talked about firewalls and the Republicans. Now, the Congress is run by Republicans. We know that. The House of Representatives is, of course, an oligarchy at this point. What the Speaker says, he says the Rules Committee says what you can talk about, what you can't. The Senate is a little bit more open, but they are not above changing the rules when they need to in order to get something. So it doesn't appear that the United States Senate or the House of Representatives is going to be anything like a firewall to all of these horrible changes.
Yeah, I am struck that the House of Representatives seem like passive observers and not real participants in making sure that we have checks and balances. And the only way to change that is to put your own House member's phone number in your phone and call them a lot and tell them what you think, because they have to get off the sidelines. And I understand that they may be intimidated by standing up to the Trump administration, but ordinary citizens are doing that. There's no reason why members of Congress can't speak out when they disagree on a specific policy. They may like Trump, but they have an obligation to make sure that their constituents are protected from pollution. And they need to get very engaged and very involved in making sure that our environmental laws and rules are not rolled back in the next few months.
Now, Judith, you got to think smart in this, of course, as I know you know better than anybody. But the Congress people that really ought to be consulted, it seems to me, are those who are from what we would call fair fight districts, mm-hmm. right? In other words, there are Republicans who will get voted in no matter what. But then there are, because of federal judges intervening and other things, districts which are quite competitive. And it seems to me if you're putting your number in a phone, you'd probably think smart and say, okay, the numbers we want in this phone are the people who are really worried about, particularly if they're my congressman, of gaining reelection.
Right. So in my phone is the phone number of my Congress member, John Faso, who I think has to play a key role in speaking out against these environmental rollbacks because there are so many serious environmental issues in his own district.
Well, you're one of the most respected voices on all of this in the country, maybe the world. So the question I'm having for you is, have you gotten him on the phone or have you had an opportunity to talk to him?
Yes. He called me just before I stepped down from my position at the EPA, and we had a very good substantive discussion about drinking water crisis in Hoosick Falls, which is in his district and which I know a little bit about, and secondly, PCBs in the Hudson River. And I was quite disappointed that he's already cast a very anti-environmental vote allowing coal ash to be dumped in streams. We don't have that going on in the Hudson Valley, but it is a problem in the country. And so he's off to a bad start on his voting record. But my conversation with him on Hoosick Falls, drinking water, and the Hudson River was pretty positive and very productive.
We're talking to Judith Enck. She is, in addition to her major role at Region 2 Administrator for the Environmental Protection Administration, is also a visiting scholar. Tell us about that, Judith.
Well, it's a really fun new experience for me. I'm at the Elizabeth Hobb Law School at Pace University in White Plains, which means every other week I drive down the length of the Taconic, and I am meeting with students and faculty. Elizabeth Hobb at Pace Law School is one of the top five law schools in the nation for environmental law. And boy, do we need smart, fresh environmental lawyers in this field. So I've been meeting with students. I'm doing guest lectures in a bunch of different classes. I'm lecturing on drinking water with a spotlight on the Hoosick Falls story. After that, I'm lecturing on the serious problem of plastic pollution in the ocean. After that, I'm lecturing on climate change. I'm doing a class on how EPA really works, which I hope will be current by the time I do that class in about 6 weeks. I'm working with the legal clinic at the law school, and I'm also trying to connect these amazing, bright environmental law students with potential employers. It is hard for new graduates from law school to find jobs, but boy, do we need them now. And I was so impressed right after President Trump signed the executive order on immigration, which we're all familiar with. The image that really sticks in my mind is not just the large number of people who rushed to airports to protest, but all the immigration lawyers who showed up at airports and offered pro bono legal services for people who were being detained or not let into the country. That was an amazing moment for immigration lawyers.
It was.
And I'm talking to the law students about what's the moment for environmental law. So those are the kind of conversations we're having. And it's just so refreshing to be in an academic setting and working with law students and law professors.
Well, you know, I've often wondered about this. For a long time, investigative journalism became things that after Woodward and Bernstein and all wanted to do. And then a lot of people wanted to go to these environmental programs. And you've put your finger right on it, Judith Enck, which is, where are the jobs when they graduate? Now, there are not-for-profits, there are a lot of them, all kinds of defense funds, stuff of that kind. But you know who's also out there are the employers who are not happy with environmental movement. So it's got to be somewhat tempting if somebody comes along and offers you 100 grand or 60 grand or 70 grand as your first job as a lawyer to go work for them.
Yeah, that's where most of the jobs are. They're not with Clearwater or NYPERG or Riverkeeper. There are not a lot of environmental law jobs in the not-for-profit world. But I have seen some lawyers take their environmental commitment into major companies and try to do some good from the inside and try to counsel their client that, you know, maybe we should just clean up the Superfund site and not fight the EPA or the DEC for decades. I'm really optimistic that we've got a new generation that has grown up with a real knowledge of environmental sustainability that didn't exist when you and I were growing up a long time ago. And I'm also encouraged by the number of companies and institutions that are hiring the title as sustainability director. I got a few calls from those companies, and I don't want to do that because I think I would be bored. But I think for young people getting into this field who want to make sure that a company greens up, that they invest in clean energy, that they use sustainable products in their packaging, things like that, the environmental field actually is an attractive place to go. And if you can't find a job, you can volunteer. All politics is local. There's no shortage of local issues. And if you really stand out as a volunteer, you will be noticed. And hopefully that might lead to a professional position.
So talk about the concept of sustainability. There's some of us who, you know, generally understand what the term means, but what does it mean to you?
Don't screw up our natural resources. That's my technical definition. But one of the things I really loved about working at EPA is the respectful relationship that we had with Indian nations. There are 8 Indian nations in New York State, and we worked with them on a government-to-government basis. And Native Americans believe that you should make decisions based on what is the impact going to be in the next 7 generations. And I think that's a really more appropriate and respectful approach to what is sustainability. When I was an advocate trying to get the New York State Legislature to act on environmental problems, golly, I would have been happy if they just looked at the impact of the next 7 years, let alone the next 7 generations. But it's recognizing, you know, that we want to leave our earth cleaner for our kids and our grandkids. And to do that, that's going to take a commitment and hard work and money, both in the private sector and the public sector. It is not easy to truly embrace sustainability. We can do that in our individual lives, but unless it happens institutionally in the business sector and in the government sector, we're just not going to have the impact that we need.
And on the state level, which I know you know a great deal about, how's Andrew Cuomo doing when it comes to his environmental scorecard?
Well, it's mixed. I think the governor deserves a lot of credit for not allowing hydrofracking in New York, for some aggressive moves on promoting renewable energy, keeping the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative in place, some real improvements in environmental funding, particularly at state parks. But at the same time, I don't understand how he can wisely call for the shutdown of Indian Point and then provide billions of dollars to keep old, aging nuclear reactors operating in upstate New York near Syracuse. You know, this is a governor whose father signed the original bottle bill, the first bill I ever worked on at the state level. And he signed the bill into law in 1981. And just recently, the governor preempted New York City's local ordinance that would allow a 5-cent fee on single-use plastic bags and paper bags. You know, people could argue that maybe that was not the exact perfect approach, but there's no question that it would have reduced plastic bag pollution in New York City. And I'm really troubled that in this era of the Trump administration, when you have a large city like New York, very thoughtfully, they spent 4 years looking at their plastic bag, paper bag fee. They adopted it, and they get preempted by the state legislature with support from the governor. So, you know, it is a mixed bag, a mixed plastic bag. But I think certainly compared to the federal level, it's much, much better than what we're facing. But a few things are outliers.
Well, these plastic bags, you think, are causing chaos. Recently, there was an analysis on NPR, or it may have been the BBC. They found the deepest trench in the country, and they found all kinds of plastic bags.
Right.
And it's ruining that environment and a lot more. So tell us what you know about what plastic bags do to our environment.
Well, plastic bags are a major problem. They're single use. They're made from petroleum. They don't degrade easily. And a lot of them get into our water bodies. They get washed off of city streets. They go through sewage treatment plants and still get into receiving waters and oceans. The statistic that I'm really focused on is that unless plastic packaging changes in the next 10 years, scientists tell us that for every 3 pounds of fish in the ocean, we will have 1 pound of plastic. We are turning our oceans into landfills. And it's even worse because the ocean currents act like paper shredders. And so a plastic bag will get shredded into hundreds of little pieces of plastic and then is consumed by fish, consumed by seabirds. I've seen many photos of autopsies of seabirds where their guts are filled with plastic bags, other plastic products. The seabirds see little red and orange bottle caps from bottled water or bottled soda. And they, because of the color, they think it's shrimp. And they will eat the bottle caps. And it really messes up their digestive system, as you can imagine. So this is a really serious problem. It's an issue that EPA was working on before I left. I hope that the issue continues. And the fundamental problem is the people who produce the plastic bags have no financial responsibility to make sure that they're either reused or recycled and not littered. In any city you walk through, you see these plastic bags in the trees. That's why the New York City Sanitation Commissioner was such a strong supporter of this New York City ordinance, which the legislature and Governor Cuomo recently killed. So I don't understand how, you know, after literally a half hour of research on the internet, there are many, many studies on the problems with plastic bags and why the state would preempt New York City. Now, the governor said he might be interested in a plastic bag ban rather than a fee, but it's unlikely that that would pass in the Republican-controlled New York State Senate. So it's kind of a situation like Obamacare, repeal and don't replace. That's what the governor did with the growing problem of plastic bags. He repealed something that New York City had on the books, and there's no real likelihood that the state Senate is going to replace it with anything that's effective.
You know, there's an old saying that money talks, all others walk. This is a pretty good example of that. The governor said, as I remember it, that the 5 cents a bag would go directly to the merchants, and that's $100 million, and that's wrong, he said. How do you react to that?
Well, you know, reasonable people can debate where that money could go. There was a decision by the city council and the mayor in New York City to have the money go to the merchants. Some argued it should go into an environmental fund. But the bottom line is the New York City government, you know, has the responsibility to look out for their community and reduce litter and reduce water pollution. This is what the city council chose to do. On the topic of money walks, I think the real issue is to look at the large number of lobbyists hired by the plastics industry to roll this back. And this is not just happening in New York. This preemption fight is happening nationwide. There was an initiative on the California ballot to eliminate the California plastic bag ban, and it was narrowly defeated. But massive amounts of money spent by the plastics industry here. I think there are 7 states where the plastic industry passed state bills saying local governments cannot adopt ordinances dealing with pollution from plastic bags. So, you know, there is the plastic pollution issue, and there's also the preemption issue. And unfortunately, the New York State Legislature and the governor blew it on both of those counts.
So you've known who your enemies are. You're a great chess player. I don't want to use the word enemies, but adversaries are when it comes to the environment. So don't you think that when a governor announces that he has, you know, $27 million or something like that in his campaign accounts, that people are giving him money for reasons? They don't just say, oh, I love you, I want to give you money. They want something back for it. And aren't some of these the people who obviously want things like this?
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, that's something for Common Cause and League of Women Voters and NYPIRG and reporters, when they look at campaign contributions, they can try to connect the dots. I know every single issue that's significant that I've ever worked on has had fierce special interest opposition. Sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. On environmental issues, we lose more than we win. But until there is campaign finance reform and, you know, major changes in the way elections are financed, this is our sad reality that we've got to deal with, whether it's climate change, drinking water, plastic pollution, protecting wetlands from being filled in, pesticide exposure, you know, every major environmental issue that really matters. There is an army of special interest opponents that are active not only in the Congress, but also in the regulatory agencies.
We are talking to Judith Enck, visiting scholar now at Pace, former regional administrator of the EPA. Judith, I guess I want to talk to you about what's in our water. I know that you've been very active in looking at the Hudson River and Hoosick Falls. GE put the stuff in, right,
yes,
into the Hudson, and now it would seem that they should take it out, but they fight you every step of the way, don't they?
Well, getting PCBs out of the Hudson River has been an epic 30-year struggle, and it wasn't until the Obama administration that we actually got PCB dredging in the Hudson, which resulted in about 2/3 of the PCBs being removed from the upper Hudson River. We never said we would get all of the PCBs. We got as much as we could get. The state of New York is free to do more dredging if they want to, particularly in the Champlain Canal, which is impacted and impaired by PCBs. But it's not 100% removal of the PCBs, but for so many years, there was no movement in getting PCBs out of the Hudson. So I think that that is an accomplishment. Certainly the work is not done. EPA is still engaged in looking at PCBs on the floodplains of the upper Hudson, which in many cases is people's backyards, public parks. So that work continues. And getting PCBs out of the Hudson River, I think, is important, along with stopping sewage discharges into the Hudson River. People ask me, what kind of surprised you on your day-to-day work at EPA over the past 7 years, the issue that you spent a lot of time on that maybe you didn't expect? And my answer is, I can't believe how much time I spent on sewage issues. Really unglamorous, really important for improving water quality. I thought we were done with sewage in the 80s, but we've got this problem of combined sewer overflows, which is a big issue in the Capital District. Whenever it rains hard, raw sewage overflows into pipes that discharge right into the Hudson or the Mohawk River. that's only going to be solved with a commitment to enforce the Clean Water Act, which has to come from the state or federal government, and also a new commitment to help local governments fund these infrastructure improvements. So I'm watching with interest in terms of whether the new Trump administration advances a stimulus package similar to the Obama administration. President Obama advanced a stimulus package his first year in office and provided EPA with hundreds of millions of dollars that we passed on to local governments to help them finance improvements in water infrastructure. At the state level, I'm really happy that the state legislature and the governor have proposed funding for water improvements. Comptroller Tom DiNapoli, a really good environmental leader, just put out a report a few days ago documenting that about $30 billion is needed statewide for water infrastructure improvements. So we really need to have this marriage of state funding and also making sure that any Trump stimulus package not only includes money for highways and pipelines, which we know he wants to fund, but also funding for drinking water improvements and sewage wastewater improvements. That's all I have to say about sewage.
No, but I still have a question on sewage.
Oh,
I'm
good.
So sorry for, for pushing you on this. But we're talking about people's feces.
Yes.
For a three-year-old who may be listening to this, people's duty in the drinking water. This is pretty terrible. I mean, this really does affect people's health, doesn't it?
Absolutely. You know, one of the really interesting things about working at EPA is I had Puerto Rico in my region, and I worked with a low-income community called Caño Martin Peña, home to 35,000 people in Puerto Rico. Whenever it rained, even modest rainfall, you had major flooding in the neighborhood. We brought down doctors from Mount Sinai who looked at what was in the floodwaters, and it was high levels of pathogens, bacteria. And then the doctors looked at, was it making people sick? And it was. That's an extreme example. We don't have anything quite like that in New York. However, in New York City, we do have a big problem with when it rains hard. Sometimes people have basement backups, which is sewage going into their basements. So we have a long way to go in terms of investing in water infrastructure. I think it's a smart use of public dollars because not only will it improve water quality, protect public health, but also create lots of jobs.
When you say infrastructure, Judith Inc., what do you mean? You mean the pipes that carry the stuff, 100-year-old pipes? Oh, what are we talking about?
Yeah, it's mostly pipes. In New York, there's a Fix Your Pipes Coalition. I mean, everyone is familiar with, you know, remember on Madison Avenue in Albany recently, a car fell into a big sinkhole. That was a water main break. Syracuse, New York, has regular water main breaks. I was meeting with the mayor a few months ago, and she has a war room set up where they try to anticipate where the next water main break is going to come. This is a real problem. You know, when there's a water main break, businesses lose water, homes lose water, people work overtime to fix it. And so it's pipes, and it's also upgrading sewage treatment plants to have more sophisticated removal technologies. And then also on the drinking water side, making sure that people have safe, clean drinking water, that takes money. So the whole water infrastructure field is important, and it really affects our daily lives.
And that's where I wanted to go next, and that's the Hoosick Falls. Let's talk about Hoosick Falls, what happened there, and how common this is to the country.
Well, let's start with there are 85,000 chemicals used in commerce. EPA only has federal drinking water standards on 200 chemicals. And then we have health advisories. EPA has health advisories on another 200 chemicals. EPA had an existing health advisory on PFOA, which is the chemical used, people most commonly know, in Teflon. It's what makes Teflon nonstick and slippery. There is a manufacturing facility in Hoosick Falls, a really nice little town in Rensselaer County on the Vermont border. St. Gobain currently runs the factory. It was previously owned by Honeywell. So two really big companies with lots of resources. Unfortunately, the manufacturing facility is just a few hundred yards from where the village of Hoosick Falls gets their drinking water, and it's from groundwater. So the chemical PFOA reached the public water supply in levels that exceeded the EPA health advisory number of 400 parts per trillion. The water consistently tested at over 600 parts per trillion. It was a local resident, Michael Hickey, who went to the town board, said, "My dad recently died of kidney cancer. I did some research. It may have been because of PFOA exposure, and he lived near the plant. I think we should test our water." The village mayor and the village board refused to do that. So Michael Hickey, who's my hero, spent his own money, sent water samples out for testing, came back with elevated levels of this chemical PFOA in a public water supply, not just an individual well serving one or two homes, which that is important if you live in those one or two homes, but a public water supply that serves thousands of people. The real sadness here is that he went back to the town board. They had the village board. They had the state health department run their own tests. The state health department learned that there were elevated levels of PFOA in drinking water. And then the state health department, the village mayor, Saint Gobain, sat at a table for over a year trying to negotiate an agreement on how to deal with this and never told the public that they were drinking contaminated water. St. Gobain told the mayor to go find public dollars to install carbon filtration at the drinking water supply. Really bad move. They should have just came up with the $2 to $3 million themselves as the polluter to pay for this, but instead they sent the mayor off to look for state or federal dollars. A local official called me at EPA and said, "Do you have $2 or $3 million to install filtration at the public water supply?" I said, "I typically don't have that kind of money hanging around my desk, but all the EPA money for drinking water goes to the New York State Environmental Facilities Corporation. Give them a call." She said, "We called them, but they won't fund it because there's a known polluter." I said, "Tell me more." That's when I learned about this issue, and I urged the state to inform the public that they were drinking contaminated water. I told them, "If you don't tell the public, I will." They didn't. I did. And I started by sending a letter to the mayor asking him to inform his residents not to drink contaminated water. Instead, the mayor said that he has this letter from EPA, but it's not really binding and it's a personal choice on whether or not you drink this contaminated water. So I then put out a press release announcing that this was a problem. The math was pretty simple. EPA had a health advisory of 400 parts per trillion that should not be exceeded. The village water supply tested over 600 parts per trillion. The state health department said they didn't have to honor the EPA advisory number, that there was that we EPA built in margins of safety that they did not have to comply with. I like the idea of margins of safety. So the residents of Hoosick Falls were informed not to drink the water, and then all sorts of other things happened afterwards. I'm rambling on for much too long, but
this is very important.
I tell the story because if it wasn't for Michael Hickey doing his own sampling, the people of Hoosick Falls today would still be drinking contaminated water.
So first of all, as somebody who has used Teflon too much in my life, how dangerous is that, just using the pans?
It's not great. DuPont stopped manufacturing PFOA over the past few years under a voluntary agreement with the EPA. Dow and DuPont are some of the major makers of PFOA along with 3M. So if you were to buy a pan today, it would not have Teflon on it. But if you have really old pans, and especially if they're kind of scratched up, you might want to properly recycle them. Yes.
That's great. Okay, so the Hoosick Falls example is frightening. But how much do we think that kind of pollution is replicated in the country?
Well, reasonable question, and I can't answer it with specifics. We know that there is a similar problem in Petersburg, New York, with PFOA from a local company, Taconic Plastics. Down in Newburgh, New York, the public water supply for over 25,000 people had to be turned off because of PFOS contamination from the local airport. I think it's a situation where if you look, you may well find it. It's not hopeless. There can be a logical approach to this. For instance, one new idea I have coming out of the Hoosick Falls experience is there really should be a state or a federal law or regulation that says if a company uses a particular chemical over a certain amount in their facility, they should be required to test the groundwater to see if that chemical is reaching groundwater, mm-hmm. and then post the results on a publicly facing website. I think in this era when EPA and Department of Environmental Conservation budgets are shrinking, which is most unfortunate, we need to look for innovative solutions like that that get information into the hands of the public and local government officials so they have a fighting chance to stop a situation like Hoosick Falls.
So let's talk a little bit about Barack Obama and his legacy environmentally. Have you met him?
Yes. And in fact, I just want to tell a quick story about how incredibly nice the Obama administration is. It was Martin Luther King's birthday in January. And all political appointees who served for more than 5 years, so I made the cut, were invited to a reception at the White House. And we were able to bring a guest, so I brought my son. And we went down to Washington, and it felt so historic because it was MLK birthday, you know, the final days of our first African-American president. And it was also the weekend that President Trump was getting into a public fight with John Lewis, which really disturbed me. So there we were in the White House with President Obama thanking his staff. And it was just very significant and felt historic to be there on that day. I've had a number of opportunities to interact with the White House staff, and the president and the first lady really set a tone of respect for their staff. I'm really proud that there was not one ethics scandal during the Obama administration. I remember when I first started at EPA, we were all invited down to the White House. And when people say the White House, a lot of times we're in the Eisenhower Executive Office Building, which is right next to the White House. So that's where most of my meetings were. If you watch the TV show Veep, which I love, that's where most of the action happens. So I'm invited down to the White House my first few weeks as EPA regional administrator. And an amazing thing happened. There was kind of an orientation and, you know, here's how it works in the federal government, because I've never worked in the federal government before going to EPA. And they had someone from the White House counsel's office come in and give us a very stern, specific lecture on ethics. And he said, we do not want any ethical scandals within the administration because we believe in good government. You, by definition, are political appointees. You're going to get phone calls. You're going to get pressured. And you should always follow the law and follow federal ethics requirements. If there's ever a moment where you feel like something is just not right, and you know it, you may not have the specific statutory language in front of you, but you know when something's a little off, call me immediately. Here's my desk phone number. Here's my cell phone number. Call me anytime. I never got that lecture when I worked in state government, and I so appreciated hearing that. Thankfully, I never had to call the guy. But the Obama administration set a tone, and that is what guided the work. I mean, I think there are lots of things that you can disagree with any administration, but you can't argue with the fact that this was a very ethical administration, and President Obama really emphasized climate change issues in his second term, got the United States to be a leader on the Paris Climate Change Accord, had EPA adopt the Clean Power Plan, the first ever federal regulation to reduce carbon emissions from fossil fuel power plants. All of that, I'm sorry to say, is now at risk.
Can you give me an example of what a potential ethical violation might have been that they were warning you about?
Well, it was across the board in the federal government. It's, you know, developers calling up and saying, don't make this a federal Superfund site because it's going to interfere with future development of my project. And yet we have test results and sampling data that shows that a site is eligible for federal Superfund. People calling up saying, you know, don't do a particular enforcement initiative because it's going to cost me money. You know, stuff like that. You receive a lot of phone calls, and oftentimes you just listen politely, you thank them, and then you do nothing.
So did you ever have one?
Sure.
But you knew what to do. You didn't have to call the guy's number.
No, I knew what to do. I never had to call the guy, but I was really happy that I had that opportunity if I needed to.
Can you tell us about a single fight that you had with somebody on a telephone that really ticked you off?
Oh, there are too many.
I'm not asking for too many. I'm just asking for one. I mean, I can remember the ones I've had where people are disrespectful or yell at me.
The things that really upset me the most were the policy fights. I mean, I also had phone calls from unnamed people in the state of New Jersey who were unhappy about some EPA policies. And, you know, they start yelling and swearing. I hate it when people swear on the phone or ever. So I just kind of like when people start yelling, I just ask them to calm down because I can't really hear them when they are yelling. And I think there was only one call that I yelled back, and it was a guy from New Jersey.
Yeah. Of all your states that you covered, was it New Jersey that gave you the hardest time?
No, it was New York. And, you know, it was not easy dealing with the Christie administration, but I developed a relationship with them where there were some things we agreed on, there were some things we disagreed on. And we could compartmentalize issues. I loved working with the governor of Puerto Rico and the governor of the U.S. Virgin Islands. I had multiple governors that I worked with. I did a lot of work in Puerto Rico because a little bit of work goes a long way. If EPA focused on a particular environmental problem, we were able to get some really good results. And Puerto Rico is facing such a severe economic crisis, multi-billion-dollar debt. A lot of the debt has been bought up by hedge funds. I really worry about the day-to-day operation of the government in Puerto Rico. I didn't spend a huge amount of time on U.S. Virgin Island issues because only 100,000 people live there permanently, but it was a very unique ecosystem. So I did some good work protecting coral reefs. We got some really good air improvements, air pollution improvements in the Virgin Islands, and really proud to get recycling established in Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands for the first time. So a little bit of work goes a long way in the Caribbean, but certainly the vast majority of my work involved New York and New Jersey.
Hmm. When you resigned, tell us the story. Why did you do it?
Well, I didn't really resign. When you're a political appointee, you are legally required to hand in your resignation when a new president comes into office. And so I stayed right till the end because I had a lot of work that I wanted to button up. And I had a feeling the new administration was not going to embrace environmental protection and environmental enforcement. So I worked right up until the night before the new president was inaugurated. So my official last day was inauguration day.
Did you hear from anybody in the Trump administration in the run-up?
No. They mostly dealt with Washington. And in fact, a really capable woman that I hired to be my deputy regional administrator, Catherine McCabe, she was tapped to be the acting EPA administrator in the interim period between when Administrator Gina McCarthy stepped down on Inauguration Day. And so there was very limited contact with the Trump transition team. We kept waiting for them to show up. They did come in a few times, and then they went off and wrote white papers, which I think they will present to the new EPA administrator. It was very different. I was very involved in the transition from George Pataki to Eliot Spitzer at the state level. And boy, did we roll up our sleeves and meet with all of the agencies and look at budget issues, look at hot issues, look at staffing concerns. None of that happened, I believe, with the EPA transition committee.
You mentioned Eliot Spitzer, a friend of mine and a guy I admire, but when that happened, was it a great shock to you that he had to resign?
Yeah, the whole thing was surprising and shocking and unfortunate and sad. And, you know, I'll always be grateful for Eliot Spitzer hiring me to work first in the Attorney General's office and then in the governor's office, but his entire staff was shocked by his personal poor judgment and the resignation. I was fortunate to stay on and work for David Paterson, which was interesting.
Why do you say interesting? Interesting is a word that is often used to obfuscate other things.
Well, it was interesting to see the two very different management styles. Eliot Spitzer knew my to-do list better than I knew my to-do list. David Paterson was much more hands-off on the day-to-day operation of the state government. So that just I didn't mean that in a negative way, but it was very interesting to see dramatically different management styles. And so I was still working for David Paterson when I decided to throw my hat in the ring to be EPA regional administrator, mostly because I was really excited about the opportunity to work for Barack Obama. And I was also hanging back to see who he was going to name as administrator. And he named a fabulous woman, Lisa Jackson, who was previously the environmental commissioner in New Jersey. And I had such great respect and admiration for her. I thought, okay, you know, maybe it's time for me to hop from state government to federal government. So really happy to have had that opportunity and stayed at EPA for over 7 years, which is kind of like cat and dog years at EPA in a political position. Not a lot of people were around for over 7 years at the agency.
So where do they go? Do they go into private practices where they can make a lot more money? Is that what happens?
Some do. Almost everyone goes and makes more money. Not me. I think these are always people who are committed to environmental protection, and they're doing a range of things. One of my colleagues, another regional administrator, was just named environmental commissioner in the state of Delaware. Many others are still looking around. Lisa Jackson, who I really respect, is now a vice president at Apple. So she travels the world trying to get Apple to be more committed to environmental protection. And Gina McCarthy is a visiting fellow at Harvard. So kind of interesting. We both are doing a little academic stop. My position at Hobb Pace Law School is just for the spring semester.
Talk to me a little bit about the obvious biggest threat of all, which is climate change. I'm so dispirited about this, that here was the Obama administration, everything in their power to Paris Accords, everything else, to get something done. And now we have a guy who says he doesn't believe that the climate is changing. Can you parse that for us?
Well, it's hard to believe. And this is the single most serious threat facing not only our environment, but our economy, our national security. To have a sitting president and an EPA nominee say that they don't, quote, believe in climate change is amazing. As if it was theological. It's not something you believe in or don't believe in. It is settled science. 97% of scientists agree that climate change is real, that it's caused by the emissions of fossil fuels and methane emissions and burning down rainforests. We know how to solve the problem. The vast majority of Americans agree that it's a problem and that action needs to be taken. But there's this cohort in Washington, both the Congress and now the executive branch, that are determined not to take action on climate change. And to be really honest, Alan, this is the issue that concerns me the most. We don't have a lot of time to turn this around. Over the last 17 years, the last 16 were the hottest. We're looking at sea level rise projections that are just startling. I spent a lot of time at EPA responding to Hurricane Sandy. We can't say that climate change caused Hurricane Sandy, but because the ocean temperature was so warm that October, Sandy was far more intense than it would have been. Close to 200 people died from Hurricane Sandy, billions of dollars in property damage. The Congress appropriated $60 billion to deal with Sandy recovery. $60 billion in tax dollars for one storm that largely hit two states. There's going to be more Hurricane Sandys. People in upstate New York dealt with Hurricane Irene. Simply from an economic perspective, not acknowledging the very real risk of climate change is so irresponsible. There's a lot we can do at the state and local level, and I appreciate Governor Cuomo's leadership on climate change, but this is really an issue that needs to be tackled nationally and then the United States as a leader in the international community. But what are the chances of Rex Tillerson, the former CEO of ExxonMobil, actually being an international leader on climate change? Some people say we shouldn't worry too much about Tillerson because at least he believes that climate change is real. But the ExxonMobil record is one of denying climate change. So this is a pretty serious issue. And if it's one issue that you should call your member of Congress on and call companies on and call banks on and call insurance companies on and make sure your kids are educated on, it's the climate change issue.
But the question is, Judith Enck, don't these people, the deniers, have grandchildren? I mean, you know, it just seems so obscene to me.
Yeah. The deniers are a very, very small group. And they're almost always funded by the fossil fuel industry. And they're putting...
Yeah, but you got a president of the United States who's a denier.
Yeah, he's terribly misinformed. You know, a reporter from New Jersey asked me what I would advise the president do on climate change. And I said he should randomly call any scientist and have a phone call about the reality of climate change. And I know that some people have been in briefing him on climate change, but it's not really had an impact. It is beyond my worst fear that we would have a sitting president in 2017 and a nominee to the EPA who do not believe in the very serious risk of climate change. We know that President Trump does have grandchildren, and one would hope that would factor into it. But so far, there's no evidence of that.
So I have a wacky question for you. Why does the stock market keep going up? And is it connected to any of this?
Oh, not my lane. I don't know. You know, my theory is because people think Trump is very pro-business, that half of Wall Street is in his administration. And so the optics are pretty positive. But I think the reality is going to catch up pretty soon. And that's just my speculation.
So I guess the question to wrap this all up with is, what would your ideal job be next, Judith Enck?
Well, my ideal job, I thought I had figured out. I was going to work on the issue of plastics in the ocean because I'm so concerned about that issue. And I think we need a ground game on the issue. We need to educate the public, educate businesses, get really good policies in place. But I'm beginning to fade away from working on that issue because the house is burning down. I'm spending a lot of time publicly defending EPA, and I'll probably work on the climate change issue. But I don't have that all figured out yet. I just discovered social media. So I'm on Twitter. Everyone should follow me at ENCKJ. So I am offering some commentary on Twitter in terms of what's happening at the national level. So I'm going to spend the next few months happily working with the students and the faculty at Haub Law School at Pace University, writing, thinking, posting things on Twitter, and figuring out the next move, probably on the climate change issue, because it's just so urgent. And I'll have to get back to plastics in the ocean after we solve climate change.
Well, I am sorry, because I could talk to you for 5 hours. And I'm so pleased that you've come and spent time with your old friends here at WAMC, where we've been interviewing you for a lot of years.
Thank you, Alan. I enjoyed our discussion, and thanks for this opportunity.
Okay, our guest has been Judith Enck, visiting scholar at the Elizabeth Haub School of Law at Pace University, former regional administrator, Region 2 of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, EPA. Judith, thanks so much again. I can't tell you what a joy it's been to have you with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on WAMC's In Conversation with Alan series, or to order a physical copy, call 1-800-323-9262 or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or on the Google Play Store.